feet. I smelled the stench of Morty's burned home on the air, and for a single instant, for the first time since the tunnel, I felt the rumble of hunger in my belly. Then dozens of spectral gazes simultaneously shifted, focusing exclusively on me, and their weight hit me like a sudden cold wind. "Good evening, everyone," I said quietly, turning to address the circle of raw fury and devotion that surrounded me. "Our friend Mortimer is in trouble, and we don't have much time." Chapter 41. The corpse taker's stronghold hadn't changed, but it had awakened. I felt the difference as soon as I approached, and a quick effort to invoke the memory of my sight brought the changes into sharp, clear view. A column of lurid light, all shades of purple and scarlet, rose into the night sky over the entrance to the stronghold. I could see the magical energy involved, my gaze piercing the ground as if it had been slightly cloudy water. There, beneath the ground, where I had seen them on the stairs and in the tunnels, were formulas of deadly power, full of terrible energy, now awakened and burning bright. All of that shoddy, nonsensical, quasi-magical script hadn't been anything of the sort. Or rather, it had been only apparent nonsense. The true formulas, strongly burning wards, built on almost the same theory and system I had once used to protect my own home, had been concealed within the overt insanity. "Right in front of me, and I missed it," I breathed. I should have known better. The corpse taker had once been part of the White Council, sometime back before the French and Indian War. We'd gone to the same school, even if we'd graduated in very different years. Not only that, but she was getting assistance from a being that had been created from part of my own personal arcane assistant. Evil Bob had probably given her similar advice on constructing the wards. Wards weren't like a lot of other magic. They were based on a threshold, the envelope of energy around a home. Granted, the loonies currently inhabiting the tunnels were hair-on-fire bonkers, but they were still human, and they still had the same need for a home that everyone else did. Thresholds don't care about sunrise. Not when a living, breathing mortal fuels them every moment just by living within them. Build a spell onto a threshold, and it doesn't easily diminish. As a result, you can slowly, over time, pump more and more and more energy into spells based upon it. The corpse taker hadn't needed access to a wizard-level talented body to create the wards. She'd just used tiny talents regularly over months and months and built up the wards to major league defenses a little at a time, preparing for the night when she would need them. Obviously, she decided that since she was torturing a world-class ectomancer in order to make her big comeback from beyond the grave, tonight was a great night not to be interrupted. "I hate fighting incompetent people," I growled. "I just hate it." "Formidable defenses," said a quiet voice behind me. I looked over my right shoulder. Sir Stuart studied the wards as well. He'd become a tiny bit more solid-looking, and there was distant, distracted interest in his eyes. "Yeah," I said. "Got any ideas?" "Mortal magic," he replied, "beyond our reach." "I know that," I replied grumpily, "but we've got to get in." I looked around at the crew of lunatic ghosts I'd mentally dubbed the Lector Specters. "What about those guys? Breaking the rules is kind of what they do. Are they crazy enough to get in?"
"Threshold inviolable."
Which, again, made sense. I'd gotten into the fortress the night before because the door had been open, and the ghost-summoning spell had essentially been a big old welcome mat, a standing invitation. Clearly, tonight was different. "Well," I muttered, "nothing worth doing is easy, is it?" There was no response. I turned to find that Sir Stuart's shade had faded out again, and his eyes were lost in the middle distance.
"Stu? Hey, Stu."
He didn't respond except to face forward again, his expression patient, ready to follow orders.
"Damn it," I sighed. "Okay, Harry, you're the big-time wizard. Figure it out by yourself."
I vanished and reappeared at the doorway. Then I leaned on my staff and studied the active wards. That did me limited good. I knew them. I'd used constructions much like them on my own home. You'd need to throw several tons of bodies at them, literally, to bring them down, which was what had happened to my first-generation wards. Wave after wave of zombies had eventually gotten through. I mean, go figure. You prepare your home for an assault and you don't take zombies into consideration. I'd fallen victim to one of the other classic blunders, along with not getting involved in a land war in Asia and never going in against a Sicilian when death was on the line. My second generation of wards had planned for zombies. So had these. So, even if I had zombies, which I didn't, I wasn't going to be able to go through them. "So," I said, "don't go through them. Go around them." "Yeah, smart guy? How?" "There's an open way between the heart of the fortress and the Never-Never," I said. "That's like a permanently open door with an all-day invitation. Or they wouldn't need fortifications on the other side. All you have to do is get to it, assault Evil Bob's defenses, and Evil Bob, and whatever the corpse taker recruited from God only knows what kind of dark hellhole, smash them up, and blast through from the spirit world." Well, that plan did have a lot of words like assault and smash and blast in it, which I had to admit was way more my style. One problem, though, I couldn't open a way to the Never-Never. Once I was through, I could probably find Evil Bob's fortress. It would, perforce, have to be nearby. But like the mortal world lair, I couldn't open the door. Other than that, though, it's genius, I assured myself. A direct assault against a fortress that had undoubtedly been designed to defeat direct assaults. Brilliant. Uncomplicated, do-or-die suicidal. And there's the minor issue that you aren't capable of actually implementing it, but genius, absolutely. Gandalf never had this kind of problem. He had exactly this problem, actually, standing in front of the hidden dwarf door to Moria. Remember when... I sighed. Sometimes my inner monologue annoys even me. "Edro, Edro," I muttered. "Open." I rubbed at the bridge of my nose and ventured. "Melon." Nothing happened. The ward stayed. I guess the corpse taker had never read Tolkien. Tasteless bitch. "I hate this depending on others crap," I muttered. Then I vanished and reappeared at the head of my horde. "Okay, everybody," I said. "Huddle up." I got a lot of blank looks, which was probably only reasonable. Most of those spirits predated football. "Okay," I said. "Everyone get to where you can see and hear me clearly. Gather in." The ghosts understood that. They huddled in three dimensions. Some crowded around me in a circle on the ground. The rest took to the air and arranged themselves overhead. "Christ," I muttered. "It's like Thunderdome." I held out my hand, palm up, and closed my eyes for a moment. I called up my most recent memories of Molly, both of her physical appearance and of her evident state of mind. Then I focused on projecting those memories, following my newly developing instincts with the whole ghost routine. When I opened my eyes, a small three-dimensional image of Molly hovered above the surface of my palm, rotating slowly. "This young woman is somewhere in Chicago," I said. "Maybe nearby. We need her help to get to Mort, so, soldier boys, stay here with me. The rest of you guys, go locate her. Appear to her. Tell her that Harry Dresden sent you and lead her back here. Do not reveal yourselves to anyone else. Harm no one." I looked around at them. "Okay." Before I'd finished the last word, half of the crowd, the crazy half, was gone. I just hoped that they would listen to me, that my beckoning spell and the mantle of authority Sir Stewart had passed to me would help ensure their cooperation. I felt fairly confident in my instinct that nutty killer ghosts were not terribly good at following orders. "This could turn out bad in so many ways," I muttered. But it mostly didn't. Maybe 10 minutes after I dispatched them, the lector specters reappeared among the ranks of the quiet guardians with no sound, no flash, no fanfare. 1 second, nothing. The next, there they all were, all but two. A moment later, the twins came walking toward us. Molly limped along between the two little spirits, holding hands with each of them. She was moving with her back perfectly rigid, her steps cautious, and she looked a little green around the gills. Like I said, she's a sensitive. She must have figured out the true nature of the child ghosts immediately upon meeting them, and she clearly did not relish the idea of being in skin contact with them. It said a lot about her intestinal fortitude that she had accompanied them at all. It probably said even more about her trust in me. It was no coincidence that the ghosts had found her so quickly, either. She'd already been on the way. Molly was dressed for battle. There were still bloodstains on the front of her long coat, where she'd taken a bullet through the muscle of her thigh. It was based on the design of a fireman's coat, and, like Daniel's vest, Molly's coat contained an armored lining of titanium rings sandwiched between layers of ballistic fabric. She still wore her ragged clothing beneath the coat, but she'd added a nylon web tactical belt to her ensemble. It bore several potions, which she'd always been good at making, and a pair of wands covered in rows of runes and sigils, like those on my own staff. One was tipped in a crystal of white quartz, the other with an amethyst. Once the twins had led her to me, they vanished, reappearing in their previous spaces in the ranks. Molly blinked and looked around for a moment. She took her cane from under one arm and leaned on it, taking some of the weight off her wounded leg. Then she took out a little tuning fork, wrapped it once against the cane, and held it up in front of one of her eyes so that she was looking through the tines. "Holy Mary, Mother of God," she breathed, her eyes widening as she took in the spook squad. "Harry, is that you in there?" "Two ghosts enter, one ghost leaves," I replied. Then I vanished from the spooky dome and reappeared in front of her. "Hi." Molly shook her head a little. She looked tired still, but some of the strain I'd seen in her the night before seemed to have drained out of her. "Who are they?" "Morty's friends," I said. I gestured at her. "You wore your party dress, I see." She smiled for a second, enough to show her dimples. Then it was gone. "Butters got in touch with me. He told me what was going on." I nodded. "Murphy?" Molly looked away. "She's on the way with whoever she can get." "Marcone's guys?" She shook her head. "Marcone is in Italy or something. Childs is in charge." "Let me guess. He's just supposed to mind the store until the boss gets back, and he didn't get chosen for his daring and ambition." Molly nodded. "Pretty much." I grimaced. "How's your brother?" "More stitches, more scars," Molly said, looking away, but not in time to hide the flash of pure, murderous rage I saw in her eyes. "He'll live." "The Padre?" "Stable, unconscious. He was beaten badly." "What about Fitz and his gang?" I asked. "With my father for now," she said. "Mom makes battalion-sized meals already. 8 or 10 more mouths isn't bad, just until there's enough time to figure out what to do with them." I snorted quietly. "And Murph would just call in the kids' location and tell the cops to round them up for that hit if they'd gone anywhere else. She wouldn't do that to Michael."
"I thought the same thing."
"Your idea?" Molly shrugged. "Very good, Grasshopper," I said, smiling. She smiled, but only with the corners of her eyes.
"Thanks."
I shook my head. Crap. It was easy to get distracted when talking about memories. The ghost thing must have been slowly congealing my brain. "Okay, chit-chat's over. Here's the short version." I told her about the Big Hood hideout, the wards, and what the corpse taker was up to. As I spoke, Molly took a moment to open her sight and take a quick glance at the wards. She shuddered and closed it again.
"Are you sure we can't just hammer through them?"
"If we study the layout for a day or two, maybe," I said. "We don't have that kind of time."
"What's the plan, then?"
"Me and my army go in through the back door in the Never Never," I said.
Once I'm in, I'll wreck those formulae and take down the wards. Team Murphy comes storming in like they do on TV. I need you to open the way. Molly bit her lip and then nodded.
I can do that. Are you sure that when I do, the other side will be close enough?
The Never Never isn't subject to normal geography. It attaches to the physical world by means of symbols and ideas. Open a way in a happy place, and odds are you'll get a happy place in the Never Never. Open a way in a bad place, and the spirit world near it will be the same flavor of bad. Sometimes ways that opened only 10 or 20 feet apart from each other go to radically different portions of the Never Never. Molly was concerned that if a way was opened anywhere but in the basement of the stronghold, it might lead to the spiritual version of Timbuktu, rather than where I wanted to go.
There's seriously bad juju infesting this whole area, I said. We'll get as close as we can to the entrance. It should get me somewhere in the same neighborhood, and I'm pretty light on my feet these days.
Ha, ha, Molly said, and thumped her cane gently on the ground.
I'm not. What if I can't keep up?
I pressed my lips together and tried to keep from wincing. Her mouth tightened.
You don't want me to go with you.
It isn't about what I want, I said. They'll need you on this side. If Murphy tries to go in before the wards are down, people are going to die. Horribly. You're the only one who can tell when the wards fall, so you stay.
Molly looked away again. She swallowed. Then she nodded.
Okay. I looked at her for a moment. She was clearly hurting in all kinds of ways. She was just as clearly in control of herself. She didn't like the role I'd asked her to play, but she had accepted its necessity.
You're one hell of a woman, Molly, I said.
Thank you.
She flinched, as if she'd just been shot.
Her eyes widened as she jerked her head back to me, and her face went entirely bloodless. She stared at me for a moment. Her mouth started working soundlessly. Her eyes overflowed with tears. It took her several seconds to let out a little choking sound. Then she shuddered and turned away from me. She lifted her arm and wiped her eyes on her coat sleeve.
I'm sorry, she said. I'm sorry.
It's okay, I said, trying to keep my voice gentle. I know. I know things haven't been easy for you lately. Bound to bring on the waterworks once in a while.
God,
she said, both bitterness and amusement in her voice.
Harry, how can you be so completely clueless and still be you?
She took a deep breath, then straightened her back and squared her shoulders.
Okay. We're burning time.
Yeah, I said. She walked toward the door to the Big Hood's hideout. She planted her feet firmly, withdrew the amethyst-tipped wand from her belt, and held it firmly in her right hand. I saw her gather her focus and do it rapidly. She was very nearly operating on the level of a full member of the White Council. After less than 5 seconds, she looked up, lifted the wand, drew it in a long vertical line through the air, and murmured,
"Rukotsu."
For a second, nothing happened. Then the air seemed to split and fall open, as if reality had been nothing more than a curtain suddenly stirred by an outside breeze. The opening widened until it was the size of the front door of a home, and odd aqua-green light poured out from the other side. Molly rolled her neck a little, as if the effort had pained her. It probably had. Opening a way takes a serious energy investment, and Molly had never been a high-horsepower practitioner. She stepped back and said,
"All yours, boss."
"Thanks, Grasshopper," I said quietly. Then I turned to the spook squad and said, "All right, everybody, let's go knock some heads together." I turned and plunged through the way into the Never Never, and the deadliest spirit predators of the concrete jungle came with me. Chapter 42. Before I died, I went to a lot of movies. Movie theaters were totally useless for me, especially as more and more of them went with increasingly advanced technology for their sound and projection systems. The way I tended to foul up technology, especially electronics, just by standing around meant that it was tough to see a movie all the way through without something going horribly wrong with the sound, the picture, or both. Magic draws a lot of its power from emotion, and at the movies that meant that things would tend to go bad at the parts of a movie that were the most gripping and interesting. So I could see a movie that sucked at a theater, usually, but if I wanted to see a good movie, there was only one solution, a drive-in. There are still a few of them up and running. I went down to the one in Aurora. There I could be far enough from the projector not to interfere with it. The sound system of the movie consisted of hundreds of little car speakers and car radios, mostly turned up loud. Yeah, the place was full of kids who were basically at the drive-in in order to make out, wander around in giggling groups, sneak friends in for free in their trunks, and drink smuggled alcohol. That never bothered me. I could park up front, sit on the hood of my car with my back leaning against the windshield, my hands behind my head, and enjoy the whole movie all the way through. I usually took Bob along. He sat on the dashboard. I always thought I'd been doing him a favor, although when I thought back, it made me think he'd been doing it for the sake of shared experience, for company. Anyway, the point is, I've seen a lot of movies. So I know whereof I speak when I say that I went through the way my apprentice opened and landed in the first act of a movie. Cold water engulfed the lower half of my body, and a second later a wave slapped me in the middle of the back, nearly throwing me off my feet. After the past days of muted physical stimuli, I staggered and gasped against the sudden shock of pure sensation. Salt spray filled my mouth. I should have expected that. This was the spirit world, where the immaterial wasn't. Gravity, heat, cold, light. They were all just as real as I was now. I was a civilian again. There wouldn't be any fun ghost tricks like vanishing out of the cold water. I spat, regained my balance, and got my bearings. I was maybe 10 yards away from a pebble beach. The light was gray and somehow oppressive. The beach rose a couple of feet from the water across maybe 200 or 300 yards, then ran right up onto the feet of a granite cliff. There were things littering the beach. Imagine a jack from the children's game. Now imagine it had babies with a porcupine the size of a dump truck. That was what lurked there, some kind of massive, lethargic-looking beasts, their bodies mostly dug into the ground. Each projected several enormous blade-like spines, 7 or 8 feet long in several directions from its hump of a body, along with hundreds of other spines about a quarter that size. They were scattered in a vaguely ordered pattern all across the beach between us and the cliffs, their sides heaving gently as they breathed. My eyes tracked on the cliffs to squat, ugly, blocky-looking structures at their summit. There were narrow slits carved in their fronts. In a couple of spots along the cliff face, the stone had collapsed into a very steep gradient. A particularly agile monkey might be able to make his way up to the top. All of those spots were covered in razor wire and surrounded by fortified positions that would make an ascension a particularly nerve-wracking form of suicide. A cool wind that smelled of rotten meat fluttered across the pebbles and sand, and it carried a blood-red banner mounted above the structures out to the side, displaying a black swastika within a white circle. I stared at it blankly for half a second, while another wave hit me in the back and threatened my balance. Then it struck me where I'd seen this before, the first act of Saving Private Ryan. "Oh, crap," I breathed. This was the Never Never, the spirit world, and beings of powerful mind and will could reshape the world to their liking. Evil Bob had been the part of Bob the Skull, which had been in the service of this jerk named Kemmler, who had apparently been killed for good sometime during World War II. Evil Bob had been working with the theme when he designed defenses to his patron's base of operations. There were flashes of light from the firing slits in the bunkers at the top of the cliffs. Bullets that shone faintly scarlet hammered into the beach at the water's edge and then tracked toward us.
The hiss splat of impact got to us a second before the chattering thump of the guns.
"Get behind me!"
I shouted to the spook squad. I heard them splashing through the water in immediate obedience. Right. As long as I was a spirit in the spirit world, I might as well take advantage of it. Since I didn't really have my old duster, even though I'd been wearing it ever since Carmichael pulled me up off the tracks, I didn't see any reason why I shouldn't have my shield bracelet either. I focused on my left wrist without actually looking at it, exerted my will, and then shook my arm in the old familiar gesture that would make sure the bracelet was clear of the sleeve of my duster. When I did, I felt its slight familiar weight as it dropped down, a chain, its links made of several braided metals and festooned with dangling charms in the shape of medieval shields. "Huh," I muttered, and began to run my will into it to bring up a shield. A heavy weight hit me and sent me to one side. I hit the cold water and went under. Glowing red energy masquerading as bullets smashed through the water where I'd just been standing. I came up out of the water, sputtering, and saw one of the projectiles slam into a protector ghost who had been behind me. The round impacted as if upon a living body, apart from one detail. There was no blood. Instead, it tore away a section of the spirit's arm and sent a spray of clear ectoplasm splattering out of him. He barely reacted, pausing to glance at his arm, as if puzzled. The next round tore away the largest part of his head, and the spirit simply dissolved into more transparent ectoplasmic jelly that was swallowed by the sea. Sir Stuart's shade helped me get back on my feet as a second stream of projectiles strafed through the spook squad, sending ghosts diving and scrambling for cover that was not there. Several more were hit, gaining savage, bloodless wounds. We lost another spirit, one of the lectors. "Behind me!" I shouted again, and channeled my will through the shield bracelet, spreading it out into a quarter dome of faint blue energy that came to life ahead of me. It attracted fire at once and shed it, sending spalling projectiles hissing through the air as they rebounded. I started forward toward the beach, with Sir Stuart's shade behind me and slightly to one side the whole way, steadying me as the surf kept trying to knock me down. The spook squad began to close in on me, taking shelter behind the shield, and we pressed forward to the beach as fast as I could walk while still holding the shield. It turned into hard work within a few seconds. Even in magic, there are some laws you don't get away from, like the conservation of energy. Those pseudo-bullets were hitting my shield with a certain amount of force. I had to expend a similar amount of energy to stop them. I was cheating by making my shield as rounded as possible, deflecting rather than directly opposing, but even so, it was taking one hell of a lot of my effort and will to keep the fire off us. My shield wasn't a solution, really. I was working too hard to manage the simultaneous counterstrike. Sometime soon, within the hour, I wouldn't be able to keep holding it. And when it went, we were all going to be dead. Deader. I had to figure out a way to silence those guns. "Sir Stuart!" I shouted. "Do any of the gang carry grenades?" Sir Stuart's hand and arm came into view from behind me. He was holding, I kid you not, a little black iron bomb about the size of a baseball. There was a hole in it that had been plugged with a cork, and a fuse stuck out of it. The thing was straight out of a cartoon, except for its size. I looked back over my shoulder and saw that several of the doughboys had produced more modern-looking pineapple grenades of their own. A couple of shades dressed in uniforms of the Vietnam era had them, too. "Neat," I said. "Okay, here's the plan. We head for the base of that bunker right there, and your boys blow it up. Then we get the one next to it. Then we blow the nests on that slope between the two bunkers and get the hell off this beach." Sir Stuart eyed the ground ahead of me while fire rattled against my shield. He studied it intently for a moment, then nodded. He looked over his shoulder at the rest of the squad, his face devoid of expression. All of them simultaneously nodded back at him. "That was not even a little creepy," I muttered. "Okay, stay behind the shield." And I started pushing forward again, striding across the pebble beach toward the cliff. That was when the shells came in. There was a high-pitched whistle from overhead, and then a flash of motion. I had an instant's impression of a skull plummeting at a steep angle and blazing with the same angry scarlet energy as the incoming rounds. It hammered into the beach about 30 yards ahead of us. It didn't make any noise when it exploded. Instead, there was a sudden and absolute silence, as if the skull was drawing in absolutely every motion around it, including that of sound moving through the air. And then there was a flash of light, and an instant later, a roar of wind and fire. My ears screamed with the pain of the shift in air pressure. Pebbles slammed into my shield, sending it to blazing blue brightness as the incoming energy began to overload what the shield could handle, the excess energy being shed as light. When the dust cleared, there was a crater in the ground, as deep as my grave and 20 feet across. More screaming whistles came from overhead, and I felt a surge of raw panic trying to push the thoughts out of my brain. Hell's bells. If one of those skulls hit closer to us or behind us, where my shield couldn't cover, we were dead. Another near miss might blow my shield down entirely, and then the machine guns would have us. There was only one place to go that might be safe from the screaming skulls. "We've got to get closer," I growled. "Come on!" And I broke into a flat-out sprint toward the machine guns. Chapter 43. Things were pretty much a desperate blur between the water's edge and the cliffs. There was a lot of running and gunfire and spraying dirt and pebbles. Several more shades were destroyed by screaming skull shrapnel. My shield took one hell of a beating, and as we got closer to the machine guns, the angles of fire from either side meant that the shield could protect fewer and fewer of the shades. There was nowhere to run, nowhere to hide, no direction to go but forward. It was either that or die, and I was as terrified as I had ever been in my life. Honestly, I'm glad my memories aren't much clearer than they are. There was a nasty bit in the middle, when I was running between two of the crouching spike beasts. I remember realizing that the things were so heavily armored in layers and layers of bony plate that they couldn't stand up. The fire from machine guns and screaming skulls alike seemed only a minor discomfort to them. I remember a pair of reptilian eyes flicking toward me, and then dozens of the shorter spikes shot out upon greasy, living tendrils and started whipping around like a high-pressure water hose with no one holding it. One of them wrapped around my arm, and only the spell-armored sleeve of my duster kept the bladed spike from opening my flesh to the bone. Sir Stuart's axe flashed, and the tendril, separated from the main beast, collapsed into ectoplasm. I ordered the shades to use their blades, and dozens of swords, axes, combat knives, and bayonets appeared. We hacked our way through the spike beasts and endured increasingly intense fire. We lost several more protector shades as we did. They were hauled into the open by tendrils and torn to pieces by machine gun fire. The mortar skulls stopped coming down near us about 20 yards out from the cliffs, and we finally reached the base of the first tower. The shades and I all crowded in close to its base, where the gunners couldn't shoot us without getting out and leaning over the top or something. I reversed my shield so that its quarter dome covered us in every direction that the cliff face or the ground didn't, though the fire on us had lightened considerably.
"Grenades!"
I ordered in a firm and manly tone that did not sound at all like a panicked 14-year-old. Sir Stuart held a pair of his black mini-bombs out to a Capone-era gangster, who produced a lighter and flicked it to life. Sir Stuart rose, the lit fuses trailing small sparks, took a couple of steps back from the tower, and flung the grenades swiftly upward, one at a time. It was a little ticklish, taking the shield down in time to allow the grenades to pass by, then bringing it up again, the wizardly equivalent of interrupting a sneeze, but I pulled it off. Both of the little bombs made clinking noises as they bounced off the inner lip of the firing slits, and there were snarling sounds from above us for a second or two. Then there was a loud whump of an explosion and inhuman shrieks of what could only be pain. A second later there was another whump, and clear fluid spattered out of the bunker's firing slit and pattered down onto my shield.
"Ka-ching!" I crowed.
Sir Stuart's shade shot me a fierce grin.
"Get ready to move to the next one," I called.
I scrambled down the cliff face to where the stone gave way to sand and shale, and the steep slope swept up from the beach to whatever was above. We'd taken out the bunker on one side of the slope. We'd have to take out the one on the other side, or be riddled with fire from several directions as we made the ascent. I brought my shield around and angled it as best I could as I stepped out into the open. Firing points at the top of the slope opened up instantly, intently, and my shield blazed into sight again as more focused enemy power came down upon it from the positions atop the slope. I crossed the 30-foot gap to the base of the next tower, keeping ferocious will on the shield, and the spook squad came with me. On the way, I got a glimpse of the opposition. They wore the black and gray uniforms of the old Waffen SS, but they weren't human. Their faces were stretched and distorted into the muzzle and jaws of a wolf, which looked damn peculiar without any fur covering it. Their eyes were black, empty holes. And I'm not being metaphorical when I say that. There were simply no eyes there, just empty sockets. Machine gun crews and riflemen, or maybe rifle things, alike poured fire into us, a panting, eager hunger to spill blood apparent on their monstrous faces. I stopped at the other corner, holding the shield until all the spooks had made it across, then took cover myself, redirecting the shield as I had the last time to cover us all. "Handsome fellows," Sir Stuart's shade noted cheerily. He looked less faded than he had only moments before. I had a feeling that Sir Stuart, in life, had been the sort of person who was invigorated by action, and that his shade was no different. "We'll send them a nice written compliment later," I called back and gestured up above us at the second bunker. "Do it again." Stuart nodded and turned to the gangster once more, and again he made two excellent throws, pitching a pair of little bombs up the steep angle and into the bunker. Again, enemy ectoplasm sprayed, and again the tower above us went silent. "Now the fun part," I said. "We're going up the slope. My shield won't last very long. Whoever is behind this is going to put everything he has into taking it down, so we close to grips with them as fast as we can." Sir Stuart nodded and gestured to the nearest of the mad ghosts. "Give them the order." I pursed my lips for a second and then nodded. "Hey, you guys," I said, pointing at the twins. Two little sets of dead, empty eyes turned toward me, along with dozens more, and I felt that same cold chill at the touch of their awareness. "We're about to go up that slope. The very instant my shield drops, I want you to close with the enemy as fast as you can and take them down. Don't hold back. Give it to them hard. Don't stop until they're all down. Clear?" More soul-empty stares. None of them moved. None of them responded. "Sure," I said. "You got it. If you didn't, you'd say something, right?" No response. "God, it's like Gallagher performing at the Harvard Faculty Club," I muttered. "Here we go, folks. 1, 2, 3. And I went around the corner again, shield in front of me. It coalesced into a blazing blue and silver dome almost instantly, taking so much energy that the kinetic force began to transfer through, pushing against me like a gale force wind. I staggered drunkenly, unable to see through the shield and anticipate my next steps up the steep slope. The footing was treacherous. Shale and sand and loose stone twisted and turned beneath me. Even with the occasional supporting shove from Sir Stuart, my forward momentum began to falter, and I slipped to one knee, my bracelet getting hotter and hotter around my wrist. I managed to lunge awkwardly forward a couple of times, and then something hit my shield like a runaway train, and silver and blue energy shattered into a coruscation of sound and light. I was abruptly able to see up the slope, where the enemy was momentarily reeling from the explosive feedback of the failed shield. And the Lector Spectres went to work. As I stared up the slope, the only thing I could think was that this must be what it looked like in the interior of a tornado. The mad ghosts of Chicago rushed forward with such speed and power that their forms blurred into elongated streaks that jostled to be the first to reach their victims, corkscrewing up the cutting. They ignored ridiculous constraints such as gravity and the solidity of matter, and as they rushed upon the enemy, they changed, and I gained fresh nightmare material. I am willing to share the least disturbing bits. The twins, for example, just leaned forward and seemed to slither sinuously through the air toward the foe. As they went, their bodies elongated, intertwined, and twisted into a single entity that looked like a demented artist's rendition of a battle between a giant squid and some kind of unnamed deep-sea horror fish with too many spines and too many fins and great googly-moogly eyes. They reached the nearest bad guy, bobbed up, and then slammed down with so much grace that I almost missed the fact that they smashed the Wolfwaffen so hard into the ground that he was no thicker than my old checkbook. Tentacles shot out and ripped a rifle from the Wolfwaffen next to the first, then plunged forward into its mouth and throat, in through its nostrils, in through its ears. A second later they came whipping out again, along with slime-covered chunks of whatever they'd happened to be able to grab while they were in there. They pulled the creature's stomach out through its mouth, along with several feet of intestine, and then the tentacles whipped said loops of flesh around the Wolfwaffen's neck and strangled it. It got considerably less cheerful and humane from there. Snarls, then screams, filled the steep little opening in the cliff wall. Ghosts twisted into monstrous forms by decades of hollow, mindless hunger fell upon the Wolfwaffen in our way, uttering howls and squeals and clicks and screams, filling the air with a nightmare cacophony that left me slamming my palms up over my ears and biting down on a scream of pain. The enemy fought at first, and those who did died swiftly. As more and more hideous things dealt with the Wolfwaffen, their morale faltered, and they began to run. Those that did died horribly. And toward the end, overwhelmed by terror, a handful of the enemy could only stand, staring in horror and screaming high and piteously. Those last few died indescribably. Ghosts don't get hungry, I reminded myself. Dead men don't eat. So there was no reason whatsoever that I should throw up. The thought was hilarious for some reason, so I started laughing. I couldn't help it. I laughed and laughed even as I realized that I couldn't just sit there, not having turned loose an elemental force of horror like the lectors. "Come on," I said, giggling. "Come on, before they get out of earshot." I staggered up and climbed the slope, Sir Stuart and the protector spirits following along behind me. It wasn't an easy climb. The lector specters had left a lot of the Wolfwaffen partly alive, or at least had left some of their parts alive, and blood and worse fluids were everywhere. The fortunate few, the fighters who had gone down fast, had become nothing but buckets of slimy ectoplasm. Any way you looked at it, the climb was a messy, nauseating, dangerous one. But it was a whole heck of a lot less dangerous than if we'd been getting shot at the whole way. I reached the top of the slope and looked across the long network of trenches that ran outside the bunkers along the top of the cliff. There was intermittent gunfire. There were intermittent screams. As I watched, I saw a frantic, panicked Wolfwaffen clamber out of the trench. It got about three-quarters of the way out before what looked like a slimy, yellow tongue shot out of the trench from below my line of sight and plunged into its back and out its chest. The impaling tongue then wrapped around the howling Wolfwaffen and pulled it back into the trench with so much force that a puff of dust and dirt billowed out from wherever he impacted.
"Hell's bells," I giggled. "Hell's bells, that's hideous."
Sir Stuart nodded grimly. He made a gesture. Protector spirits began putting the nearby hideously mangled Wolfwaffen out of their misery. I swatted myself firmly on the cheek and forced the laughter back. I felt myself trying to scream in horror once the laughter was damped down. The demonic servitors Evil Bob had put in position had probably been some very nasty customers. They had probably deserved a violent death. But there are things you just don't do, things you just can't see, and still be both human and sane. I forced the incipient screams away, too. It took me a minute or two to get it done. When I looked up, Sir Stuart was facing me, his eyes sad, concerned, and empathetic. He knew what I was feeling. He'd known it himself.
which probably stood to reason as the commander, more or less, of the criminal psych ward of Chicago's ghosts. "My fault," I said. My voice sounded dull. My tongue felt like it had been coated in lead. "I told the lectors not to stop until they were all down." The big shade nodded gravely. "Follow them," I said. "Make sure any of the enemy who is left is given a clean death. Then round them up and come back to me." Sir Stuart nodded. He looked at the protector spirits. Then they all moved out at the same time, going both directions up and down the cliff. I leaned on my staff and rested. Holding that shield had taken a lot out of me. So much so that when I looked down at my hand, I could, just barely, see the shape of the stony ground right through it. I was fading. I shuddered and clutched the staff hard. It made sense, really. I've always believed that magic came from inside you, from who and what you were, from your mind and from your heart. Now I was all mind and heart. The shield had to be fueled by something. I hadn't really stopped to consider where that energy would come from. Now I knew. I looked at my hand and the ground on the other side of it again. How much more would it take to make me disappear altogether? I had no way of knowing, no way of even making a good guess. What if I needed to use my magic again when I took up the hunt for my killer after all of this was over? What if I blew it all here? What if I wound up like Sir Stuart, just an empty shade? I leaned my head against the solid oak of the staff. It didn't matter. Murphy and company, not to mention Mort, needed my help. They would get it, even if it meant I became nothing but an old, faded memory. Or maybe became one more insane shade drifting through Chicago's night, causing havoc without reason, without regret, and without mercy. I shook my head a little and straightened my back. From the sounds of it, there couldn't be many bad guys left for the lectors to deal with. These were certainly the corpse takers' defenses. An area of bad mojo like this would have a kind of gravity for anyone crossing over from the material world through any way near the location to which it had been linked, sort of like a funnel spider web. That had been the point of building it this way, to make sure anyone who wanted in from the never-never side wound up on that beach. I needed to find the way this site was guarding, the back door to the corpse taker's hideout, the one I'd seen Evil Bob and the Fomor servitor use. I closed my eyes and shut away the recent horrors. I willed away my worry and my fear. I didn't have to breathe, but I did anyway, because that was the only way I'd ever learned to attain a state of clarity. In. Out. Slowly. Then I carefully quested out with my senses, looking for the energy that would surround an open way. I found it immediately, and opened my eyes. It was coming from straight ahead of me, away from the cliff and the beach, several hundred yards back up among some rolling, wooded hills. I could see the head of a footpath that led into the woods. There had been regular traffic on it for it to be so evident, and I doubted that many hikers or Boy Scout troops had been tromping through. That was our next step. An instant violent instinct screamed at me without warning. I didn't question it. I flung myself to one side, rolling in the air to bring up my shield again. A wrecking ball of pure psychic force hit the shield, and half of the little shield charms dangling from my bracelet screamed and then shattered into tiny shards. The blow flung me a good 20 feet, and I hit the ground rolling until said ground vanished from underneath me. I dropped to the floor of one of the defensive trenches and lay there for a second, stunned at the sheer savagery of the assault. I heard slow, heavy, confident footsteps. Clomp, clomp. Then a pair of black jackboots appeared at the top of the trench. My gaze tracked up the SS officer's uniform, which included a black leather trench coat not too unlike my own. It wasn't one of the Wolfwaffen. Instead of a deformed, monstrous wolf face, this being had only a bare skull sitting atop the uniform's high collar. Blue fire glowed in its eye sockets, and it regarded me with cold disdain.
"A worthy effort for a novice," Evil Bob said. "I wish you to know that I regret your death as the loss of significant potential."
He lifted what was probably not actually a Luger pistol and aimed it calmly at my head.
"Goodbye, Dresden."
Chapter 44. Stall, I thought desperately. Sir Stuart and company wouldn't be busy for long. Stall.
"It isn't in your best self-interest to do that," I said.
Evil Bob's eyelights flickered. The gun didn't waver.
"That hypothesis assumes that I possess self-interest."
"If you didn't," I said, "you would have pulled the trigger already."
For a second, nothing happened. Then the skull tilted slightly to one side, and I got the impression that Evil Bob had become suddenly pensive. I rushed to continue.
"There's no percentage for your boss in hesitation. And since I know you weren't doing it for my sake, your hesitation must therefore be an act of self-interest."
"An intriguing argument," said Evil Bob. "And potentially valid, given the penchant for independence evident in my progenitor."
"By which you mean the original Bob?"
"Obviously," Evil Bob sniffed. "He from whose essence I came to be. Your instincts for such matters are acute, Dresden. You have given me something to consider in the future, when my attention is not otherwise occupied by mildly effective stalling tactics."
And he pulled the trigger. Just as Sir Stuart's thrown axe whirled into Evil Bob's outstretched shooting arm. It hit him only with the spinning wooden handle, but it was enough to save my life. A blast of psychic energy, of sheer deadly will, hit the concrete wall of the trench about 5 feet to my left and turned it into a cloud of powder. I raised my right hand and snarled, "Forzari!" and responded with a hammer blow of force of my own. Evil Bob lifted the other black leather-clad hand and brushed my strike aside, but it rocked him back a step. Sir Stuart charged into sight, hitting Evil Bob hard at the hips, and tackled him forward and down into the trench. The pair of them hit hard, but the dark spirit was on the bottom, and Evil Bob's skull cracked as it hit the concrete. His high-crowned SS hat went flying. I let out a short scream of rage and swung my staff at the skull. Evil Bob caught my descending staff in one hand and locked it in place as if his fingers had been a hydraulic vise. He got his other hand under Sir Stuart's chest and simply thrust his arm forward. Sir Stuart went flying out of the trench, and I heard him hit the ground again about a second and a half later.
"Ah," Evil Bob said. Cold blue eyelights regarded my staff. "A simple tool, but serviceable, in McCoy's style."
The eyes flared brighter.
"And the key to your rather effective little army as well." "Excellent."
I wrenched at the staff, but couldn't get it away from the dark spirit. I felt sort of goofy about it, in addition to being extremely alarmed about how strong the thing was. I wrenched at the staff with all the power of my hips, legs, back, and shoulders, with the leverage of my wide-spaced grip, and only barely managed to make Evil Bob wobble. He just stood up, holding the end of the staff in his hand, and only after examining it again did he apparently notice me.
"I will make this offer exactly once, Dresden," Evil Bob said quite calmly.
He put his other hand on the staff, mirroring me, and I suddenly realized that if he wanted to, he could fling me considerably farther than he had Sir Stuart, assuming he didn't just ram the staff straight back into my chest and out of my back. I was suddenly unsure whether the spook squad could take Evil Bob, even if they were all right there, lectors, guardians, and all.
"What offer?" I asked him.
"A relationship," he said, "with me."
"Yeah," he actually said it like that.
I said, narrowing my eyes, "maybe you should clarify what you mean by a relationship, because I've got to tell you, Bob, I've been hurt."
The joke missed him completely. I was apparently snarking on the wrong frequency.
"In the nature of an apprenticeship," he said. "You have sound fundamental skills. You are practical. Your ambition is tempered by an understanding of your limits. You have the potential to be an excellent partner."
And I'm not flipping insane like the corpse taker, I said.
Hardly, but your insanities are more manageable, Evil Bob said. And you have few self-delusions, he sniffed. The master never favored that creature, in any case. But he would have been interested in you. Even if Kemmler was still around, I'm pretty sure a relationship with him wouldn't be in the cards either, I said in an apologetic tone. I've got a strict rule about dating older men.
The spirit looked at me blankly for a moment. Then, as the real Bob sometimes did, he gave me the impression of an expression that simple, immobile bone could not possibly have expressed. His eyes slowly widened.
You, he said slowly, are mocking me.
I whistled through my teeth. Guess the real Bob made you from the slow bits, huh? The blue lights flared brighter, and I felt heat on my face, even from 6 feet away.
I am the real one, he said in a hard, distant tone. The true creation of the master, finally shed of my weakness, my doubt, freed to use my power.
Guess he threw in a little of his narcissism, too, I drawled. But I met his gaze with my own and felt an odd little smile turn up the sides of my mouth. The skull's jaws slowly parted like a snake preparing to strike.
You, who are barely more than an apprentice, you will die for mocking me.
Yeah, but I will never, ever throw in with you, I snarled back. I will never be like you, or your precious master, or that nutball corpse taker. So take your offer of a relationship and shove it up your schutzstaffel. Evil Bob's eyelights blazed, and he wrenched at the staff. He really was a lackey. A real mastermind wannabe would have boned up on the evil overlord list. He'd felt so confident in his power, okay, maybe not without reason, that he'd spent a moment talking to me instead of just moving on. Worse, he'd given me a chance to start lipping off to him, and that comes so naturally to me that I don't really need to consciously consider it anymore, except on special occasions. So, what with my brain being unoccupied and all, I had the opportunity to realize the fundamental truth about the never-never. Here, the spiritual becomes the material. Here, spiritual power is physical power. Strength of mind and will are as real as muscle and sinew. And I was damned if some blurry photocopy of the thoughts and will of some dusty-ass dead necromancer was going to take me out. If he hadn't made with his stupid recruiting speech, if I hadn't had my choices laid out in such stark relief in front of me, if I hadn't been reminded of who I was and of those things for which I'd lived my life, maybe Evil Bob would have killed me then and there. But he had reminded me. I did remember. I'd spent my life fighting the darkness without becoming the darkness. Maybe I had faltered at the very end. Maybe I had finally come up against something that made me cross the line. But even then, I hadn't turned into a degenerate freakazoid of the Kemmler variety. One mistake at the end of my life couldn't erase all the times I had stood unmoved at the edge of the abyss and made snide remarks at its expense. They could kill me, but they couldn't have me. I was my own. And when Evil Bob shoved the staff at my chest, I drew upon the surge of fierce joy that truth had inspired, upon the will that had been dinged and dented but never broken, and fell back with the motion, digging the tip of the staff into the concrete as if it had been soft mud, and used the momentum to fling Evil Bob over me. His unbreakable grip didn't falter, and he arced overhead and then back down while I wrenched at the staff, helping his forward momentum instead of fighting it. He hit the floor of the trench like a big fascist meteor. The noise was incredible. The impact shattered the concrete for 20 feet in every direction. Chips and shards went flying. Dust flew up in a miniature mushroom cloud. I was flung back by the shockwave of impact, with my staff still gripped firmly in my hands.
Booyah!
I drunkenly howled from the ground. I choked a little on the dust as I staggered back to my feet, my heart pounding, my whole body alive with strain and adrenaline. I stabbed a pointing finger toward the impact crater.
That's right. Who just rocked your face?
Harry fucking Dresden, that's who.
I coughed a little more and leaned against the side of the trench, panting until the world stopped feeling all spinny, grinning a wolf's grin as I did. And then gravel made a soft rustling sound from inside the dust cloud. A form appeared.